We who believe in freedom cannot rest until it comes. We who believe in freedom cannot rest. We who believe in freedom cannot rest until it comes. Until the killing of black men, black mothers, sons.
And you're listening to Building Bridges, Realizing the Dream, Across the March of Time, 1963 to 2013, for Jobs and Justice, Marching on Washington. Spurred on by the acquittal of George Zimmerman in the shooting death of unarmed African-American teen Trayvon Martin and the recent Supreme Court decision that ripped the heart out of the Voting Rights Act, legislation that was written in the blood of a people, both of which, again, exposed the wide racial divides in the nation. People packed their lunches, boarded those buses. Some of us got Cinnabons on the way up there, and we headed to D.C. on the 50th anniversary of the 63 March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. They came again for voting rights, for educational opportunities, for employment and workers' rights, and against the system of incarceration, police violence, and laws that permit the murder of their children.
All unsettled issues. You'll listen to and contrast the demands and sounds from the 63 March with those of today. You'll hear the most heartfelt messages and evocative presentations that remind us of the original 1963 message, that the struggle for freedom and economic rights must coalesce for meaningful change. Be inspired, be renewed, and recommit to agitate for jobs and freedom. After listening to interviews with civil rights icons, the sheroes and heroes who recount their sacrifices of then and prescriptions for today.
And we begin our sojourn by listening to A. Philip Randolph as he opened up the march in 1963, from then to now.
We are gathered here in the largest demonstration in the history of this nation. Let the nation and the world know the meaning of our numbers. We are not a pressure group. We are not an organization or a group of organizations. We are not a mob. We are the advance guard of a massive moral revolution for jobs and freedom. This revolution reverberates throughout the land, touching every city, every town, every village where black men are segregated, oppressed, and exploited. But this civil rights revolution is not confined to the Negro, nor is it confined to civil rights, for our white allies know that they cannot be free while we are not. And we know that we have no future in a society in which 6 million black and white people are unemployed and millions more living poverty. Nor is the goal of our civil rights revolution merely the passage of civil rights legislation. Yes, we want all public accommodations open to all citizens, but those accommodations will mean little to those who cannot afford to use them. Yes, we want a Fair Employment Practice Act, but what good will it do if profit-geared automation destroys the jobs of millions of workers, black and white? We want integrated public schools. We also want federal aid to education. We want a free democratic society dedicated to the political, economic, and social advancement of man along moral lines. Now we know that real freedom will require many changes in the nation's political and social philosophies and institutions. For one thing, we must destroy the notion that Mrs. Murphy's property rights include the right to humiliate me because of the color of my skin. The sanctity of private property takes second place to the sanctity of the human personality. It falls to the Negro to reassert this priority of values because our ancestors were transformed from human personalities into private property. It falls to us to demand full employment and to put automation at the service of human needs, not at the service of profits. For we are the worst victims of unemployment. Negroes are in the forefront of today's movement for social and racial justice. And so we have taken our struggle into the streets, as the labor movement took its struggle into the streets, as Jesus Christ led the multitude through the streets of Judea. The plain and simple fact is that until we went into the streets, the federal government was indifferent to our demands. It was not until the streets and jails of Birmingham were filled that Congress began to think about civil rights legislation. It was not until thousands demonstrated in the South that lunch counters and other public accommodations were integrated. It was not until the Freedom Riders were brutalized in Alabama that the 1946 Supreme Court decision banning discrimination in travel was enforced. And it was not until construction sites were picketed in the North that Negro workers were hired. Those who deplore our militants are in fact supporting segregation and exploitation. They would have social peace at the expense of social and racial justice. The March on Washington is not the climax of our struggle, but a beginning. Look for the enemies of Medicare, of higher minimum wages, of Social Security, of federal aid to education. And there you will find the enemy of the Negro, the coalition of dictocrats and reactionary Republicans that seek to dominate the Congress. We must develop strength in order that we may be able to back and support the civil rights program of President Kennedy. In the struggle against these forces, all of us should be prepared to take to the streets. We here today are on the first wave. When we leave, it will be to carry on the civil rights revolution home with us into every nook and cranny of the land. And we shall return again and again to Washington in every growing number until total freedom is ours. We shall settle for nothing less, and may God grant that we may have the courage, the strength and faith in this hour of trial by fire, never to falter.
We are here with Merle Evers, and throughout my history, one of the most moving times was the loss of Medgar Evers, certainly a great leader, and I wonder what comes to mind to you as we are here this many, many years later in front of the Lincoln Memorial for the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington.
Well, it's been 50 years since Medgar was assassinated. We celebrated his life and the life of others who'd given so much in the state of Mississippi just a few weeks ago. But to be here and to participate in this second, should I call it, March on Washington, I'm truly blessed to still be here. I have fought long and hard over this period of time for justice and equality, but mostly to keep Medgar's name and his work alive. And to be sure that people of all generations realized who he was, what he did, in a time when the media did not follow what we were going through in the Deep South, and particularly in Mississippi. It was only much later and closer to the time of Medgar's death that the media began to really focus in on what was happening and to see so many things change, that his assassin was finally convicted after 30 years of hard work, when people told me I was crazy, nothing would happen. And it just says, keep persevering if you believe in something. Don't let it go. This march will certainly have many, many young people here who probably would not even thought about 50 years ago. And I hope that they can come away from this, not only hearing of the history of that first march, but realizing that they have opportunities today that we very seldom dreamt of 50 years ago. And that women, hopefully, will finally get their due at this march because they have not had it before. And it's been one of those things that's kind of gnawed away at me, because women have been the backbone of this struggle. Women of all colors. And it's about time, it's long overdue, that we recognize that. So I'm excited about being here. And in a sense, it kind of closes out a big chapter for me. It's forward now. It's no looking back. It's no anger. What is. What happened, happened. Medgar is now recognized as one of the leaders of the movement. His assassin, he's gone now. And one of the things that Medgar asked me to do the last night of his life was merely take care of my children. I have done that with the help of others. They are adults. The first child is deceased now, but they are adults and who have done so well, and I see the grandchildren coming up, and it just fills my heart with pride.
I have to ask, Medgar Evers was really a child himself when he lost his life in you. Do you see this generation as, at this point, having the kind of strength, the kind of moral conviction, the kind of humanitarian imperative to work for their people, to work for freedom in the way that our hero, Medgar Evers, did, as you did, as the many unnamed women did at that point?
I think I have to say yes. However, they have not been tested. We were tested. Unfortunately, I think my generation that gave so much felt a little tired, a little weary, and we said we have accomplished all that needs to be accomplished. Many shut down sharing those experiences because they were too painful. What is painful to me now is to see so many young people who don't know of that history and who could care less. And that has to be reversed. So that's one of the challenges that we have today.
And the jail system now, the pain of seeing so many of our young men, particularly African-American men, Latino men, who are not in the education system that people fought so hard for, but are in the prison system. What is to be done? What are the lessons that we can learn from your experiences in the Deep South, from Medgar Evers?
You can never stop teaching, you can never stop preaching, you can never stop leading the way. It's an ongoing effort. Once you stop, once you slow down, you leave a void there. It's something that we have to look at very carefully. We as Americans, regardless of race, creed, or color, and find ways to instill in the hearts and minds of our young people that history and their responsibilities for all of the privileges that they share now. All we have to do is to look at, as you mentioned, the prison system, and particularly the number of young black men who are there. The question that begs to be answered is why.
I'm absolutely proud to have met you here, and thank you for all that you have done and that your family has given to all of us for freedom.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank
the best
you.
To you.
President, founder of Rainbow Push Coalition, the Reverend Jesse L. Jackson, Sr.
Today we appeal upon the President and the Congress to have mercy upon our plea
fresh from jail in North and South Carolina. I was blessed to be here 50 years ago. Thank God for the journey, 50 years of tragedy and triumph. The stench of Medgar was blood in the air. We marched as Dr. King dreamed in 63. I was with him and a band of SCLC warriors as he felt the agony of the nightmare approaching in 1968 in Memphis. He said the pendulum swung between hope and hopelessness. He celebrated the joy of our progress, the freedom from barbarism and the right to vote. He would celebrate the joy of our political progress, the return of President Aristide to Haiti, the freedom of Nelson Mandela in South Africa, and the election of President Barack Obama, who would have felt acutely the pain of stagnation, retrogression, unnecessary wars, drones, and the neglect of the poor. For there is too much poverty and hate and war. He was tormented by poverty, and using war and violence as remedies was unacceptable. His mission was to disturb the comfortable and comfort the disturbed, determined to remain permanently maladjusted so all of God's children have a meal for their bodies, an education for their minds, and health for their infirmities. The day he would be disturbed, banks bailed out, homeowners locked out, insurance companies bailed out, Detroit and Birmingham bankrupted. He was still paying an awful price for the misadventure into Iraq. He said, too much war, too few jobs, too little social uplift, leads to moral and spiritual bankruptcy. When he was killed, his poverty rating went down, but his values and standards went up. He said, reject me, if you will, those who want to embrace me, but I will speak and will be heard. And so keep dreaming of the constitutional right to vote. Stop the madness in North Carolina and Texas. Keep dreaming. Keep dreaming, revive the war on poverty. Keep dreaming. To go from stop and frisk to stop and employ, stop and educate, stop and house, stop and choose schools over jails. Keep dreaming. Keep dreaming student loan debt forgiveness as a stimulus. Keep dreaming. Revive the U.S. Civil Rights Commission with the conscience of our nation. Keep dreaming. Restore foreclosed housing. Keep dreaming. Comprehensive immigration reform that includes Africa, Haiti, and the Caribbean. Keep dreaming. 50 years later, we are free but not equal. Keep dreaming. Choose life over death. Futures over funerals and more graduations than less funerals. And so keep the faith. And through it all, it gets dark, but the Lord is our light. Keep hope alive.
We have the extreme privilege to be with Reverend Jesse Jackson, Jr. You hit all the right notes up there. And those notes, as far as I'm concerned, were the kind of melding of civil rights and economic rights. Could you elaborate on that for us?
At this occasion, it's a great temptation to engage in reflection and observations, reflections, and sometimes become melancholy. But we need today appropriations, and we need legislation to address inequities. The social gap between races has basically closed, but the disparities in health care, the spread in education, in housing, in jobs, in trauma units is growing every day. And those gaps will require legislation, and those who are locked out need appropriation.
In 63, there were many issues. There were economic issues. There were civil rights issues. And then, as now, we seem to be on the road to joining those issues. What do you think are the most important issues that can spur people on to a movement?
Today, we have the unemployment lines have grown. The poverty has grown. The middle class is sinking. Jobs out because of trade policy, drugs and guns in. Clearly, we must go another way.
Reverend Jackson, when you were coming up in a manner of speaking and during that period in the 60s, there really were enclaves of social activism and the youth took a primary role. At this point, African-American youth, Latino youth are being incarcerated at record numbers. How do you build that interest and that social involvement to that change?
Martin unleashed a lot of energy, you know, but Trayvon was killed last year, but 136 unarmed blacks were killed by police, by vigilantes, by security guards. 136 were killed. 2.5 million Americans in prison, 55% are African-American. Prison telephone calls, $1.5 billion a year, collect costs from prison. Prison labor, pretrial detention. Our youth are on the attack. And now that we have put in something called Parent Plus Loans, making education less affordable, and cut out some of Pell Grants, our youth are on the attack. They have every reason to fight back.
Thank you, Reverend Jackson.
We will hear from the president of the oldest civil rights organization in America, in the NAACP, they say, fired up, ready to go. We will hear from Ben Jealous. Fired up, ready to go. Fired up, ready to go. When they say, no, you can't, we say, yes, we can. When they say, no, you can't pass a real racial profiling ban with teeth, we say, yes, we can. Because, yes, we did in New York City. When they say, no, you can't pass the Dream Act, no, you can't pass marriage equality, no, you can't abolish the death penalty, no, you can't expand voting rights in any state south of the Mason-Dixon, we say, yes, we can, because yes, we did just 5 miles from here in Maryland last year. When they say, no, you can't restore the full force of the Voting Rights Act. No, you can't raise the minimum wage, not with this Congress. We say, yes, we can, because, yes, we have again and again. And so let us claim some victories right now. Let us say, yes, we will pass Trayvon's Law from coast to coast. Let us say, yes, we will protect the right to vote with all our might until we win the fight finally once and for all. And let us say, yes, we will raise the minimum wage, because you cannot survive on $7.25. Yes, we will. Yes, we will. Yes, we will.
Well, we've managed to wrest Ben Jealous away from many appropriately adoring media persons, but you have really distinguished yourself in the issues of certainly stop and frisk racial profiling to begin with. And I wonder if you can talk more about what you think that message is today, as more and more and more African-American Latino youth wind up within the prison system, or worse, devastated, brutalized, indeed murdered at the hands of the policing apparatus in this country.
Marchers matter, and that when we stand up together, we win. I mean, think about it. Last year, we were in New York City, silent march to Mayor Bloomberg's house. And, you know, folks in the city can be fairly cynical, right? So they're like, what, you want me to be silent? Well, what message is that going to send, right? And then we're going to the mayor's house. Well, he's not going to be there. Well, 70,000 people showed up. We were expecting 15,000. 70,000 show up. The march is longer than the march route itself. Stop and frisk start dropping. The mayor comes out and lies and says, stop and frisk are going up. Well, that means murders are going to go up. We get to the end of the year, stop and frisks are down, homicides are down. We go into this year, we beat the man in court, and we beat him in his own city council twice. And that is what we can do there when we stand up. That's what our young people are doing. That's what our old folks are doing. We're joining together, and we're winning. In Maryland, in just the past year in Maryland, we have abolished the death penalty, passed marriage equality, passed gun safety reform, extended voting rights, passed the Dream Act, and that's just one state in 1 year. And so our movement must remember that we are triumphant even in these tough times, that we make possibilities happen even in moments of great peril, and that when we are organized, we can always win, but we must be organized.
So I saw you actually about a few months ago in front of the Fast Food Forward demonstration for minimum wage in New York City. How important is it to accent those issues and to merge them with a whole range of other issues of protest?
Yeah, I just came back from meeting with fast food workers, retail workers, people working on 725 across this country and not surviving. And I have no doubt that if Dr. King was alive today, he would be right there fighting for those workers the way he was fighting for sanitation workers. And it's incumbent on all of us to stand up and say, raise the minimum wage and raise it high. Because the folks who've been working on the minimum wage, we've been robbing money from them for decades. If we had just kept up with inflation, the minimum wage would be $15 right now. And when we look at young mothers who are forced to access public assistance, even though they're working 40 and 50 hours a week, because you can't get out of poverty working 40 and 50 hours a week for $7.25, we all need to admit that something is wrong in our country and we all got to be part of fixing it.
Dr. King, when he left, began to organize the Poor People's March. How do we really take this forward, build the youth momentum, and really create that mass movement that's going to change some of the power relationship from the have-mores to the have-nots in this country?
On August 29th across this country, as workers walk out across this country, it's accelerating even as our movement for justice is accelerating. Next week, we'll turn in 1.7 million signatures, almost a half million of those signatures gathered from on cell phones by young people who may not even own a computer, doing everything they can to get involved. And so this movement for jobs and freedom is still very much alive today, and both issues are converging now as they did then. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
We who believe in freedom cannot rest. We who believe in freedom cannot rest until it comes. We who believe in freedom cannot rest. We who believe in freedom cannot rest until it comes.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.